I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The movie Selma had us talking this winter about a 50-year-old landmark of black protest, voting legislation, and liberation. Attica came 5 years later, the bloodiest prison massacre in American history, out in Wyoming County of Western New York. 29 protesting prisoners and 10 corrections officers that they had taken hostage were all shot and killed by New York State troopers in a matter of minutes after Governor Nelson Rockefeller gave up on talking, said no to amnesty for the prisoners, and ordered his troops to fire away. Attica is another sort of touchstone with resonance as deep as Selma's in American life today. Even as major elements of the long-buried Attica story come to light, and post-Attica patterns of crime and punishment in this country come clear. Heather Ann Thompson is our guest this hour with lots of help. She's professor of history and African-American studies at Temple University in Philadelphia, though she's on her way to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And she's deep in writing a big book on the many meanings of Attica for a reviving conversation on race in America, on drugs, incarceration, inequality, culture, employment, history, and progress, too. She's telling stories of Attica in September 1971 that were never supposed to come out. Just to remind you, here are some of the people that we saw and heard on television over a five-day siege back then. First, Tom Soto, a sympathetic observer who had been invited to listen in on the bargaining with the state. And then L.D. Barkley, a leader of the prisoners' uprising who was killed in the raid.
The inmates' complaints were over brutality, beatings, macings, gassings, and indiscriminately thrown into solitary confinement, letters censored or held up altogether, slave wages, cells, which were 8x6. Their blankets, for example, were washed once a year. All of the demands that the prisoners made were correct demands, justifiable by the conditions they lived under.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be driven or beaten as such. The entire prison populace has set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed.
That was L.D. Barkley, and before him, the observer, Tom Soto. Welcome, Heather Ann Thompson. So many people have grown up knowing enough about Attica to raise their fists about it. I'm thinking of Al Pacino in the movie Dog Day Afternoon. He's a bank robber, and he shouts, "Attica, Attica," and immediately, draws his crowd. But so few of us have ever known really what happened. Can you put it in a capsule? Who started it? What were the demands? Were they justified?
Well, like today, ironically, this many years ago, in 1971, prisoners were faced with pretty horrendous conditions of confinement. And they were determined to bring attention to them. They, in fact, tried very hard to work through the system to get those things addressed. They wrote to the Commissioner of Corrections. They wrote to a sympathetic New York State senator. But the bottom line was there was no real change forthcoming, and frustrations began to bubble over with all the things that we just heard Tom Soto at the time tell us about, the guard abuses, the lack of cleanliness, the clean conditions, the lack of basic showers, I mean, you name it. And also working conditions, right? Being asked to work for terrible wages. And so an actually really unremarkable event is what touched off what became, I think, really was first a riot, an actual just kind of chaotic uprising as prisoners were confined to a tunnel in the prison and to prevent them from going out to the exercise yard. And in their fear, they, fearing again guard retaliation, that's why they were being locked in, they just kind of lost it and they
Can I just
over.
Remark on another fascinating cultural thing? The voice of L.D. Barkley evokes the 60s.
Right.
I mean, it was a time when black men and others could raise their fists and say, we're making this demand without inhibition. Right. And a lot of them were answered.
Well, I was going to say, so what started actually as a relatively kind of chaotic thing very quickly metamorphosizes into this intense 60s civil rights rebellion in 1971. It's really on the heels of that because, of course, after work, trying to work through the system, right, like many civil rights activists did, without any real change, people get frustrated and they become very militant and they decide we must demand these changes rather than ask for them.
So what got into Nelson Rockefeller? There he is, you know, the richest man in the world, big aspirations, sort of a good guy, if you believe the New York Times line on things. But why did he, you know, say, no amnesty, we're not going to talk to him, I'm not going to go there, I, Nelson, and in the end, you know, let him have it?
Well, I mean, it's a difficult question to answer why anyone would decide after 4 days of quite successful negotiations and the only thing holding it up was that the prisoners needed amnesty for actually having rebelled, why he would not give in. But essentially, Attica was his line in the sand. He had deep political aspirations himself to be seen as tough on crime. Certainly giving in to prisoners was not on his agenda. And I think he really felt it that he was facing a threat to his authority, a threat to the United States. And remember, he was a real cold warrior in the way he dealt with all things political, even though he was pretty liberal on domestic policy.
Remind me, had he made his commitment then to take drug addicts off the street, put them on Welfare Island or Roosevelt Island, as it was called?
Of course, his drug law, his serious drug laws come after Attica in 1973. He's actually seen as someone who's quite sympathetic to drug reforms prior to that time, prior to Attica. But Attica is a real turning point for him because he's really seeing his authority challenged. And all of the observers that were there watching these negotiations were insisting, please, you know, Mr. Governor, continue to negotiate. Come to Attica. Help these guys with their problems. The hostages were saying, Mr. Rockefeller, please come. Do something for these men. Their grievances are legitimate. But indeed, it was already decided. He had already amassed, just every battalion of the New York State Troopers outside of the prison. They'd been there for days. They were angry. They were eager to get in. And he allowed them to retake the prison with virtually no training in this, armed to the teeth. People were passing out weapons left and right. No serial numbers accounted for. And let them retake the prison, both angry and tired and really inflamed. And the result was disastrous, which everyone who was there had told him it would be.
Forgive me. You can imagine it, though. I can, going the other way. Nelson Rockefeller showing a spirit of flexibility, statesmanship, rising above the battle. Nothing to die for here.
Well, interestingly, I think a lot of the prisoners naively hoped for that. And indeed, when the helicopter began circulating over their heads as the assault is about ready to begin, some of them actually wonder, is this Rockefeller coming? And it's sort of one of these tragedies. But at the end of the day, he was not going to have prisoners, and particularly black prisoners, even though it was a multiracial event, it was, you know, overwhelmingly black prisoners. He wasn't going to let them decide this, I think.
Were those men in the helicopters and elsewhere firing guns, were they prepared to lose all the hostages, to kill those New York State employees with the prisoners? Was that part of their plan?
Well, I mean, I think let's put it this way. No one was firing from the helicopters, but certainly the troopers that came in and the corrections officers that came in with guns could not have remotely imagined that you could save the hostages in that kind of a circumstance. And indeed, they did not. They knew full well that going in with guns blazing, remember that the prisoners don't have any guns. This was completely an unnecessary show of force, excessive force, that there was going to be casualties. And again, the prisoners were more humane. They actually believed that if they had hostages, state employees, that the state would negotiate because they wouldn't want to kill their own. And to really underscore the level of hostility towards the prisoners and the unwillingness to deal with the civil rights movement in the prisons, they were, in fact, willing to take out their own.
Were they surprised in the end, do you think?
The hostages?
Yeah. No. Well, I'm thinking especially of the prisoners.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think at the end of the day, they just couldn't believe it. But then they said, but I guess that's right. You know, it all sort of made sense to them at the end. But I mean, I think many prisoners were, in fact, politicized simply because they couldn't believe that the state was acting as it was.
They were men of language, of negotiation,
right,
of drama.
Right.
Who could have been prepared for what descended?
Right. And in fact, there had been earlier rebellions in other New York City and New York State prisons that had not ended in gunfire. So there was a reason to believe that even if there was a retaking, that it might be with nightclubs or something. The show of force at Attica was staggering. And it was at the hands of men who were not trained in that kind of riot retaking.
I'm thinking John Lindsay was the mayor of New York City at the time, a Rockefeller rival. Mm-hmm. Maybe this was a part of a politician's motivation or drive.
Well, again, this is a deep irony because there had been New York City jail riots in 1970. And unlike Rockefeller, Lindsay had actually gone into the prison. He was willing to talk with prisoners.
Yeah, it's a big difference. Mm-hmm. It's a big difference. I got to know Rockefeller around this issue later, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk about it. So many things hit home here. We're talking with the historian Heather Ann Thompson, who's bringing back the drama of Attica in 1971. Another one of the outside observers watching the negotiations inside Attica was my friend Tom Wicker, a North Carolina liberal and New York Times columnist who had hired me for the Washington Bureau a couple of years earlier. On the PBS documentary series Eyes on the Prize, Wicker spoke of how shaken he was, alongside the Bronx's Puerto Rican Congressman Herman Badillo, by the wholesale killing that they both thought was avoidable.
We had predicted the day before that it was going to be a massacre. Herman Badillo turned to me and said, "I don't know what the hurry was." He said, "There's always time to die." And I don't know what the hurry was either. You know, those guys weren't going anywhere. They were inside 30-foot walls. It was September. It was getting cold up there. The food was running out. The sanitary conditions were bad. The place smelled awful. I don't know what the hurry was. They could have waited 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. Those guys would have given up. They didn't have to go in and kill them all. But they did.
Coming up, how the legend of Attica took on a life of its own in American politics. Or as another movie had it, when the legend becomes the fact, print the legend. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Revisiting the prison protest and then the massacre at Attica in Western New York in 1971. Before the smoke had cleared, the meaning of what had happened, the storyline for press and public was being shaped at the highest levels. Here is part of the phone dialogue initiated by Nelson Rockefeller with the President of the United States, Richard Nixon.
I have Governor Rockefeller for you, sir. There you are.
Mr. President,
I know you've had a hard day, but I want you to know that I just back you to the hilt. The courage you showed and the judgment in not granting amnesty, it was right, and I don't care what the hell the papers or anybody else says. I think that you had to do it that way, because if you would have granted amnesty in this case, it would have meant that you would have had prisons in an uproar all over this country.
That's right.
And you did the right thing. It's a tragedy that these poor fellows are shot, but I just want you to know that's my view, and I've told the troops around here there to back that right to the hilt.
Well, aren't you great, Mr. President? I only called you because I wanted to alert you that we were going in. And
right.
When we went in, we couldn't tell whether all 39 hostages would be killed and maybe 200 or 300 prisoners.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty big, you know.
Yeah.
But the way it worked out, there were about 1,200 prisoners. By taking and putting down a gas attack from helicopters, and then having sharpshooters on the walls, our own men, we were able to pick off either from the wall or as our men went in, the men who had the knives at the throat of the hostages, and they did a fabulous job.
How many? I only got the report this morning. What is the latest report? How many people?
Seven hostages were killed. These were the guards.
Those are guards. Seven.
It appears now, Mr. President, as though quite a few of those were killed prior to this. In other words, that they'd been dead.
Uh-huh. You can prove that, can't you?
This is the hospital.
The hospital can prove that.
Oh, yeah.
They can find out how long the guy's dead.
That's right. And it's a Catholic hospital, so it's outside of our jurisdiction.
Right. How many prisoners were killed?
32.
32 prisoners killed.
So
tell me this. Is this a Are these primarily blacks that you're dealing with?
Oh, yes. The whole thing was led by the blacks.
I'll be darned. Are all the prisoners that were killed blacks? Are there any whites?
I haven't got that report, but I have to. I would say just offhand, yes.
Yeah.
We did it, though, only when they were in the process of murdering the guards or when they were attacking our people as they came in to get the guards.
You had to do it. You know, by golly, we're not going to have any we just cannot tolerate this kind of anarchy.
That was Richard Nixon on the phone with Nelson Rockefeller in the immediate aftermath of the massacre at Attica in 1971. Our guest, Heather Ann Thompson, is an historian deep in a book on what actually happened. What did Nelson Rockefeller and Richard Nixon get wrong in that conversation, and why?
Well, pretty much everything. One of the most extraordinary things about the retaking was not just its violence, but was the way in which it was spun by the state thereafter. The smoke had not cleared from Attica when state officials stood outside of the prison and announced that all the hostages had been killed by vicious inmates who had slit their throats. Mm-hmm. And this was an utter lie. That is not what had happened. In fact, they'd all been killed by trooper bullets. Everyone killed during the retaking was killed by trooper bullets or correction officer bullets. And when he told the president that there were several of the guards had been dead for days, also not true. I mean, it was really this kind of extraordinary effort to reshape or to shape public opinion about what Attica had been about. And this ran on the front page of the New York Times, the front page of the LA Times, and every newspaper in between because of the AP reporting. And, you know, it was a game changer because it sent a message to America that Attica was not about civil rights rebellion. It was about inmate brutality when nothing could be further from the truth. And I might say that even the deaths that we talk about today was the tip of the iceberg. In fact, you know, almost 100 were severely, severely wounded because, in fact, Rockefeller was incorrect. They were not just targeting certain people, although certain people were targeted. It was just this random melee of shooting. Some people had bullets, 7 bullet wounds. And then there was a horrible roundup of the prisoners and then subsequent torture that went on for a great many weeks and months.
And Nixon's trying to probe there and find out what's the black piece
exactly.
of this thing.
Well,
how do you read that?
Because fundamentally they were concerned that this was about a black revolution brewing in America. And in fact, it's notable that even though Attica was a small town affair in many respects, it was a state prison. From the moment Attica jumped off, the FBI was intensely interested and, in fact, was reporting back to every branch of the military and the president and the vice president. And meanwhile, the surveillance was stepping up on the Black Panthers in Oakland. There was this intense fear that Attica was not just representative of, but actually was part and parcel of some sort of a revolutionary conspiracy.
Hmm. You can just see a whole culture of fear starting in those two men that's going to become doctrine.
Absolutely. And indeed, the way that Attica is spun just really fuels and fulfills already this movement to react to the civil rights movement that's been in existence for decades through criminalizing African Americans by changing the laws, by clamping down, by supporting law and order over everything else. And Attica, for those people already really engaged in that since Lyndon Johnson really starts the war on crime with the Law Enforcement Administration Act, this gives them the yes, this is exactly why we don't need to worry about prisoner rights. We need to worry about crime in the streets.
Yeah, this has happened before in Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Explain that precedent.
Well, right after the Civil War, we had 4 million newly freed African Americans who also were determined to actually have a real voice in the polity and really have jobs and really have civil rights. And the response to that in the South after the Civil War was that white folks just changed all the laws and criminalized black spaces. And overnight, black penitentiaries go from being all white to all black, but not because blacks committed all the crimes and white folks didn't commit any. It was purely a policy shift, a policy decision. And the same thing happens after the Civil Rights era in this country, and Attica becomes a crucial fueling of that sentiment on the part of those who would rather see safety, quote unquote, war on crime policies over more humane institutional policies in prison.
You know, I'm searching my own memory, and I remember a lot of the events. What I don't really remember was how my own mind was processing this changing of the symbols, mm-hmm. how sort of the vibrant black manhood, say, of Brother Barclay becomes, a boogeyman, mm-hmm. a scare object.
Well, I think let's...
In the culture, and I'm wondering if I understood it.
Right. Well, for much of white America, of course, blackness is always seen that way. And one of the most remarkable things about the Civil Rights 60s was that enormous strides were made. Enormous liberation movements were created and strides were made. But the backlash to that was pretty intense. And the backlash could exist because it was always there. There was always this sense in white America.
You know, I want to introduce Bruce Western. He's the sociologist at Harvard who's made a career of doing the numbers on what was just beginning then, the mass incarceration era. I asked him this week to mark that Attica moment and its effects.
It was a remarkable event, Attica, because it thrust American prisons into the national spotlight. It joined the issue of prison reform and prison conditions to a broader wave of social activism. And very shortly after the Attica riot, incarceration rates began to grow across the country. And we can look at the trend in incarceration. Really, 1972 is the turning point.
But we got two things here. We got a radical activism and a kind of build-up reaction of incarceration. Which is the real one from almost 50 years distance?
It seems like we've been living under the shadow of the reaction rather than the progressive activism over the last 40 years.
Bruce Western, explain the surge in what's now called mass incarceration right after Attica. What caused it, really?
The most immediate causes were changes in criminal justice policy. And really, there's just been a fundamental revolution through the 80s and 90s, chiefly. And so the first thing that happened was drug enforcement became very intensively policed and punished. And so we see a big escalation in drug arrest rates through the 1980s. This has a big disproportionate effect on African Americans. There's a change in penal policy, so people who are arrested for drugs are now being sent to prison, which wasn't happening earlier. Mandatory minimum sentences are being widely adopted for a whole variety of offences, not just drugs. And then in the 1990s, we see the emergence of very long sentences. So, you know, California passes three strikes and other states begin to follow suit. And so three strikes mandates very long terms of incarceration for people with three felony convictions. Truth in sentencing becomes widely adopted through the 1990s. Truth in sentencing requires defendants to serve 85% of their sentence, and this also increases time served. So these three changes in penal policy, intensified drug enforcement, mandatory minimums, and the emergence of very long sentences in the 90s, these are the three fundamental changes in sentencing policy that really caused the prison population to skyrocket. So now the rate of incarceration is about five times higher than its historic average.
So, Bruce Western, how's to account for a policy that has had such a racially lopsided effect?
It's a great question. I think it's one we don't understand extremely well. Mike Tonry, the legal scholar who's written a lot about American sentencing policy, coined this term malign neglect. And in Tonry's formulation, it wasn't so much that policymakers were acting out of an active racial animus. It's just that they never seriously considered the racially disparate consequences of the policy choices they were making. And they discounted those policy choices, of course, because they were falling most heavily on poor African American communities whose welfare wasn't seriously considered.
That was Bruce Western of Harvard. My guest is Heather Ann Thompson of Temple. Is it really that hard to figure out in retrospect what was going on here, this broad pivot toward mass incarceration?
Well, I think that what historians would take the longer view, that we would look at how and study very closely the ways in which policy, and particularly justice policy over the course of the American history, is racialized. And certainly from my vantage point, it does not, with you know, complete respect to Michael Tonry, does not suggest any kind of benign outcome. I mean, I think that much like people were much more willing, for example, to see Southern policymakers as overtly racist in the policies they made in cities like Birmingham or Selma. But when it became national and when it became Northern, it was very difficult for people to, both scholars and pundits and journalists, to say, well, you know, this is about white supremacy. This is about racism. This is about white privilege. And it was then about policy. It was then about, well, you know, we don't really, you know, it's not about blacks that we're policing. It's about high crime areas that we're policing, this kind of thing. But again, the long history of this shows very clearly, and Attica shows. I mean, quite frankly, the retaking of Attica, the brutality, the inside of it was so racialized. Mm-hmm. These cops were, the state troopers that were coming in were not just, you know, they were just shooting people. They were also using racial epithets and the beatings that went on afterwards. And any white prisoner that dared to stand with a black prisoner was racialized and you know, and given terrible epithets after their name. So it really is fundamentally about the way in which, I think, the way in which whiteness is, blackness is policed, and the justice system becomes a proxy. The police become a proxy in many respects for the white community, and I think the justice system becomes a proxy for the white desire to kind of contain African-American behavior, desires, rights, claims on the citizenry, and claims on the nation.
It's such a fascinating time to be rethinking this, even, I mean, maybe especially for white people. Ta-Nehisi Coates is sensitizing us to, you know, the sort of thinly veiled white supremacy that runs through our whole system, culture, and politics. You hate to think, though, that you have to be black to understand what was going on. He writes, and I think he, in by now, we would all grant that America's entire history, as he says, is marked by the state imposing unfreedom on a large swath of the African-American population. And there's no evidence that that trend has ended, as he says.
I think he's absolutely right. And his brilliant essay on reparations makes clear that even if we were to look at something like housing policy, and we would like to see this as a benign policy that had unfortunate consequences, you know, he simply debunks that. And he, of course, his work is, you know, he draws on a lot of really important historical work on this to show that, no, you know, racial covenants were not anything but racial, right? They were about policing white spaces, keeping them white. And the long-term effect of this is that, you know, you definitely are targeting one group of people over another. I will say, though, and this is really true, that mass incarceration becomes such a massive system that many people are caught in its web. It's way disproportionately black and brown citizens. But it's also, you know, I mean, it is poor people. And and that is one of its most serious flaws, that it is so disparately targeted to people who can't afford justice.
It's becoming a commonplace. It popped out on Oscar night. Somebody said there are more black men under correctional control,
right,
in prison, probation, parole, than were enslaved in 1850. Mm-hmm. And that there is some sort of recurrence of, as Ta-Nehisi Coates says, imposing unfreedom on the black and brown. You have a particular angle, though, in this discussion, especially the roots of it, that mass incarceration is a deeper problem in our society today, even than the isolation of blacks in their own neighborhoods, ghettos, or even than the poverty in the black world. That mass incarceration is itself now the root of many, many, many bad symptoms. Explain.
Right. In my own work, I pretty strongly argue that mass incarceration is itself a force in communities that is destructive, that impoverishes people, that reduces their civil rights. I mean, I'm not the only one that argues this. But in other words, that rather than mass incarceration just being one of the many things that happens to people, because it is so comprehensive, because it is so devastating, when you incarcerate an entire community, and take away their rights to vote and make it impossible for them to get jobs and orphan their children. You literally change the course of history and you change the fate of entire communities. And so in that sense, mass incarceration becomes its own animal. It becomes its own entity that changes history. And I will say what's really interesting about studying this period, the 60s to the present, is we get a little confused. I mean, are we living in a more progressive time? Is it a more regressive time? I mean, it's a very interesting, complicated time when you consider, for example, in 1965, the same year that we passed the Voting Rights Act, we also begin a war on crime. And so in the same time that we're allegedly endorsing civil rights and supporting them, we are beginning a policy that's going to disfranchise wide swaths of the black community. So these things are all true. And I will say that the legacy of Attica is important to remember, not just for the brutality, but also for the incredible belief that these guys had that if you fought for something, you could get it, you know, that humanity was possible.
Yeah, we were talking about these strange links when in a program on Selma a few weeks ago, the Black Sunday in Selma came one day before the first Marine landing at Da Nang in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I mean, the tensions between Lyndon Johnson and Martin Luther King on Selma were nothing compared to what would become their open war around Vietnam. Coming up, the Attica effects to this day at Attica itself and in Boston. Azan Reed, not long out of Walpole, is going to tell one man's story. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. With the historian Heather Ann Thompson, we're zigging and zagging through the Attica links, from a pinnacle of 60s protest culture to a state massacre in Attica's D Yard in 1971, from there to the law and order politics of the U.S. in the 70s and 80s, to the reality of racially imbalanced mass incarceration today. We had a chance this week to talk and listen at length with Azan Reed, who has lived a lot of his 23 years along this wayward path, from unsupervised boyhood along Norfolk Street in Dorchester, into drug retailing, and then prison again, and then into a sort of awakening. I'm going to ask you, Heather, if there's a parable in this story.
And I feel like a lot of people, they're getting it now. Like, you see the numbers out there. There's a lot of kids doing things that's good in school. A lot of kids getting good grades these days. A lot of kids are dressing better. They feeling more confident about themselves in different areas. It's getting a little better slowly at a time, but I feel like it's going to take another 20, 30 years to even see that. I can say in the 90s and stuff like that, every day I walked out there, it was crazy. You had to worry about getting robbed every day. The neighborhoods we lived in was trashed. Dumpsters all over the place, empty lots, needles everywhere, condoms everywhere, crackheads everywhere, people coming right up to your house, coming up to you asking for crack. You're a kid. It was different back then, so we grew up in a hard time, and parents started breaking up, the drugs, the partying, kids not having the parents around. The numbers just, you know, got overwhelming. They didn't think it was going to get this bad, I guess, but it did, and, you know, like, these same kids that was 8, 9, 10 years old, seeing their parents do all these crazy things in the 80s and the 90s, like, it just barreled over. Like, they have no guidance. The old school rules from the 50s, 60s, 70s, where the neighborhood take care of the kids, it's not there no more, man. Like, people are just next door neighbors are arguing. Kids can't play together. They're mad because this person got a better looking car. Like, everybody's materialistic. It wasn't like that before. Like, it's just the times has changed. And parents going to have to, like, stay together. And even if you're not together, you know, raise the kids together, you know. My mother was the first generation here. She left Trinidad when she was 15 to come to England and then to America. So that's hard alone for her. And then, like, it's going to boil over into me because she got to work so hard. So what am I going to do? Either I'm going to get a job and work hard at 15, 16 and be able to buy some sneakers, or either I'm going to go out there and I'm playing basketball, I'm learning the neighborhood. These are my friends. These are their uncles and stuff. I see what they're doing. They're making money fast. I'm probably going to do that too. It's a choice. But without the right support and cast around you, in your house where it starts at first, some choices get mixed up somewhere and you start to think that these are the right choices and they're the wrong ones. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're learning from the wrong people. My uncle make $10,000 a day outside the streets, and me thinking it's cool. Seeing him mess with 100 different girls all the time, and me thinking it's cool. You know what I'm saying? Seeing him do drugs or something, and me thinking it's all right because he has money and different things. Oh, he did it. I could do it too.
That was Azan Reed, 23 years old, of Boston, Massachusetts. He's an aspiring cook now, stopping thinking, making his own choices. I wonder, Heather Ann Thompson, what do we learn from one young man's well-told story?
Well, I find it just absolutely poignant and heartbreaking, because his story could be the story of so many young men of color in America who look at their communities and their lives and try very much to make sense of what in the world has happened over the last decades to these communities. And so often, and I hear it in this young man as well, so often internalize it and say, you know, it is so internal. You know, if I would have had parents that would have been around, or I would have had more willpower, or if I would have gotten a job and not sold drugs, is a deeply kind of deeply self-critical community. And I hear it all the time. And the reason I say it's heartbreaking is because what, of course, people don't understand is that this was all the result of a policy shift. This was a chosen path. When we embarked on a war on drugs, before we had this level of crime, before we had this level of trauma, we created the trauma. And one of the examples that I always use is Prohibition. I mean, we're very fascinated right. with the gangster era, but if you watch Boardwalk Empire or any of these shows, you quickly realize that when you make substances illegal, you destroy communities. You increase violence, you take away parents to imprisonment, you create terrible addiction problems because there's no more social services, certainly after the 60s, to take care of addiction. We criminalize addiction rather than treat it as a public health problem. And so communities are suffering mightily and have very little kind of broader context or frame for understanding what in the world happened. They take it as, this was my father's fault or my own personal
feelings. But I'm wondering, it's so interesting, but would Azan Reed have been better off if drugs had been sort of legal or decriminalized, if his uncle wasn't making big money of it, but maybe his father was using?
Well, I think that's not really the question. The question is, was his family or his comparable family 30 years earlier better off with a real job in a real community before drug criminalization? So that, you know, we saw that, you know, with the on the wake and the heels of deindustrialization and so forth, with very few jobs, when you criminalize drugs, that becomes the informal economy, becomes the economy.
Right.
And, you know, desperate people have to do desperate things. Now, the addiction, interestingly, I mean, there's two different tracks, right? There are the addicts and there are the dealers. There's the economic motive for dealing, and then there's the trauma of addiction. But all of that in the 80s and 90s is being treated as a criminal justice
right.
problem rather than a health problem on the addiction side, and B, an employment problem, an economic problem.
And C or D or E, a carefully constructed trap for a young man
right.
like
Azan.
And he fell right smack into it. But
let's be clear. White children and white teenagers are also using drugs, and they are also addicted to drugs.
At somewhat higher rates, in fact.
Absolutely. And they're not being criminalized, and so therefore their communities are not being eroded in the same way. And this is fundamentally, again, about the policy, where the policing is concentrated, where the absolute policies are being implemented is going to have an effect on community. And ultimately, and I do argue this in a piece that I write, ultimately it does become a pretty messy chicken and egg, because ultimately if you hyper-police a community and mass incarcerate a community, violence does become a problem. But again, we have to be really clear about the chicken and egg, and we have to be really clear about why would a community in 1950 that was not violent become a community that's so violent? And of course, the snap answer is there's something wrong with poor black people or brown people, but the logical, historical, and policy-oriented answer is no, this is responsive. And we have to take those policy matters very seriously if we're serious about communities and we're serious about young men like him being able to make it.
Heartbreaking, as you say, but it's also kind of wonderful that he has found his way out of that maze
right.
with a clear head. Two things we haven't even mentioned this week. Astonishing. The George Williams case at Attica today, mm-hmm. a man brutally beaten by guards, pushed down the stairs after his legs were broken, should have died, would have been left for dead happily by those men. And yet today the case against them was a wrist slap or less.
Right.
They lose their jobs. They keep their pensions. There's no state acknowledgement of criminality or state responsibility. At the same time, the Attorney General, Eric Holder, is telling Ferguson, Missouri, we're going to turn your police department upside down. This is insane, the rationales for picking people up for jaywalking. It's all racist. It's all nonsense. And we're going to turn you inside out. So, among other things, I wonder, what if, you know, Eric Holder had gone into Attica maybe 40 years ago and said, this is an insane way to run a prison system. What if he went into there today and said, by the way, the world is watching.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing what you're doing. And we're gonna have cameras all over everything for the rest of time.
Well, let's be clear. Eric Holder does this investigation of Ferguson because people were turning out night after night after night in the streets, not just in Ferguson, but in New York, in Philadelphia, in Boston, across the nation, basically demanding accountability. What in the world is going on with police-community relations? This was a response to a groundswell of activism in communities across America. Now, interestingly, after Attica, there was also a clamor, a groundswell demand, investigate what had happened at Attica. And the Department of Justice got involved then, too, although there they said no civil rights violations have taken place, or at least there's not enough for a case. I mean, ironic, right? Because, of course, there were myriad civil rights investigations. So I guess what I would say is that it's important that we have these investigations. But at the end of the day, we have to really look at the broader issues, not just isolated to Ferguson and that police department or Attica and that prison, but, you know, what happened at Attica to that guy and with between him and these guards, or I should say what these guards did to him. This plays out in prisons all across America. I mean, women are shackled when they give birth in prison. Children are held in solitary confinement. People are abused on a daily basis. So we really need a broader societal look at prisons and at the whole policy of incarceration that we have embraced over the last 4 years.
But let me be Pollyanna again then. I mean, the good news from Eric Holder, at least the tone of what he said, was the federal the government has a responsibility and can act to end these absolutely rotten situations, as John Doerr and the Civil Rights Division did in the late 50s, early 60s, about lynching, for example, and then in the voting rights violations. The federal government did assert itself, and he was very unshy today about saying that we will in Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
There's a program of action there, at least implied, shall we say.
Right. Well, I am by nature fundamentally optimistic. So I hope that that is what will in fact happen. But I guess the historian in me does make me worry a bit, because indeed we were willing to go into the South. We were willing during the civil rights era to go in and investigate civil rights abuses in the South. It was not so easy to do that when those same abuses happened in Detroit, Michigan, or happened in Philadelphia, or happened in Chicago, or happened with the Boston Police Department. So I do worry a little bit about how deep this kind of probe can go, because at bottom, the kind of policing practices we have embraced as a nation, or certainly the policies that we've embraced, don't alarm every community, but they definitely alarm the communities that are being targeted by them. And I think that this report came so much out of the pressure on the Justice Department. Again, night after night after night, people turning out and saying, this is not America, and we need to find out what's going on. I'm delighted he responded to that. But I worry a little bit. I think history shows us that the Justice Department can get involved, but in very selective ways. And you know, and we have to push. We have to push for it to be
a couple of quick questions while we're talking prisons. What does the privatization of prisons have to do with all this?
Well, it certainly doesn't make their reform or ending mass incarceration any easier, because there's a profit motive now attached to incarceration. To put it bluntly, if you own a prison that's private, you want it sounds kind of gross to say, but you want crimes to be committed, because then your beds are full. That's a really bad policy decision.
Another question. We're reminded, I think it was Forbes magazine, reporting that there are more women in American prisons than there are women in China, Chinese, Indian, or Russian prisons combined.
Mm-hmm.
Why in the world? And what's to do about
well,
that?
Well, and men. I mean, we are targeting more people for prison than any other country on the globe. And women are now being the next quickest target group, particularly black women and girls.
15,000 women and girls imprisoned in 1980, more than 110,000 today. That's a 650% increase. Why?
Well, again, let me just go back to the original policy point, which is that we made a decision to criminalize space in all new ways, to make things that had not been illegal now illegal, and to make things that had been illegal have much more severe policies. So when you're constantly policing communities, the numbers of people in prison are going to rise. And certainly now, because of drugs, we police everything. You know, policing welfare, policing drugs, policing schools, policing communities. I mean, let's remember that when Eric Garner was killed recently in New York, what was he doing? I mean, he was selling illegal cigarettes. That's an example of that kind of low-level misdemeanor, broken window policing that has just filled our jails but has also led to people being killed by police. And that's why the policy needs investigation, needs a rethinking.
And what time we have left, I want to come back to the mass incarceration point because you say it's central and all sorts of other people have other theories of where the problem begins or where it's going to be attacked first. But you're notion, very simply, is that communities don't become, you know, criminal hotbeds, you know, over a decade for nothing. And that the problem is that the sort of, shall we say, viable younger males of the community have been removed or crippled or villainized. Spell that out in a way that we can't forget it as this conversation continues.
Well, let's just remember that throughout American history, there's always been a lot of poverty and there's always been a lot of poor communities. And there's always been a lot of segregation. There's been many of these ills have always been there. But we have never seen this kind of emptying out of communities and the kind of devastation of communities that we've seen in the last even 10 to 15 years. And that is why I say the central policy is incarceration, because when you lock someone up, you make them unemployable, you take them away from their families, and at bottom, you absolutely have a presence in the community. It's like living under siege. And so that erodes communities, and we have ultimate evidence. I mean, there's just study after study after study that shows the devastating impact of that. So it's not to minimize poverty or the economy or jobs or anything. Those things are vital for healthy communities. But throughout history, we've had those always and at times more or less. But what we've never had, ever in American history or in any other country on the globe, is this level of dealing with social problems through a criminal justice lens. That's what's new, and it's been disastrous.
And by putting a criminal justice lens on it, it's fundamentally another way of saying seeing those viable men as, first and foremost, and maybe exclusively, criminals.
Yes, men and women.
I'm marveling that we didn't see this all along, that taking those people off the street meant taking the young manhood out of a community. And of course it was going to be injured.
Well, and again, we have to think about for who would this be troublesome? And certainly to lock up so many African-American men and women, boys and girls, is not as troubling or disheartening to people who don't see it, don't feel it, and indeed do believe in the criminalization of blackness. But it is devastating to the people who are affected by it, and they're speaking out. And that's indeed what Ferguson is about. It's what all of this is about. It's about recognizing that communities are being eroded and that this is damaging. It's generationally damaging.
I'm fascinated. You're a wonderful young female academic and white. Did you have an aha moment when you said, get them out of the prisons, get them back into circulation?
Well, although I am an academic and though I'm white, I mean, I grew up in the city of Detroit and I watched this firsthand. I watched the, you know, devastation of the drug war firsthand and the devastation of racism in a community firsthand. So part of that's personal, but part of it is once you study this stuff, you realize how unprecedented it is and you have to make sense of it.
Congratulations on your work, and thank you hugely for raising our consciousness in your writing and on the air. Thank you, Heather Ann Thompson. Also, Bruce Western and Azan Reed. We'll hear more from you. Thanks also to Elizabeth Hinton, Lisa McGurr, and the Pacifica Radio Archives. There's more reading and listening on our website. Muhammad Ali and Richard Pryor respond to the revolt at Attica, and a look at the artifacts of Attica. We're going out on Attica State by John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Our show is produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Tomeno. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our attorney general. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.